This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In, where we spend the hour on a couple different topics. Today, we'll hear from an art therapist at an Indianapolis hospital who's found a unique and thoughtful way to comfort the families of those who have died from COVID-19. And later, we'll check in with a Purdue researcher on a new article that explains the link between things like climate change and pollution to the harmful algal blooms that threaten the Great Lakes and the communities that surround them. But first, a look at the biggest state headlines of the week with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Doing okay. But let's start today with some non-COVID news. The story from Indianapolis. Three police-involved fatalities between late Wednesday night and Thursday morning. What happened?
Yeah, so the first one was streamed on Facebook. Sean Reed, Jashawn Reed, led police in a chase after IMPD stopped pursuing him. He began a Facebook Live and parked his vehicle behind a business. From there, police say an officer found him with his vehicle and began engaging with him to attempt to arrest him. Reed began running, and officers chased him on foot. Now, according to IMPD, Reed was tased and then exchanged gunfire with IMPD officers and was killed. On the Facebook Live video, at the very end, you hear one of the officers comment, "I think it's going to be a closed casket." So that Reed's death led to a few protests yesterday, including a large protest at the city county building downtown and one near where he died at Michigan Road in 62nd. The second was a pregnant woman who was walking along an expressway ramp. She was struck and killed by an IMPD officer on his way into work. And then the third was 19-year-old Mikhail Rose. Police were investigating a burglary at an apartment complex when they say a man with a rifle began shooting at them. They exchanged gunfire and killed Rose. Several organizations have called for an external investigation into these deaths, including the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus.
And I understand there were some protests downtown yesterday as well surrounding this?
Yes, yes. So that was the large protest at the city county building
downtown.
Yes,
yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, that was big news that came out of Indianapolis yesterday. Thanks for sharing that. Now let's get to the COVID news. The back on track plan we heard about a week ago, and it was right after our show aired. Well, what does it say?
Yeah, so the governor's back on track plan, because every plan has to have a name. Holcomb announced it last Friday, shortly after All In. It breaks reopening the state into five steps. The first one was the stay-at-home order, shutting everything down. And then stage two began for 89 out of 92 counties on Monday, which reopened non-essential businesses and shopping malls with capacity restrictions. Three counties, Lake, Marion, and Cass, were delayed under the governor's plan. But overall, the entire plan would reopen the state, removing all restrictions by July 4th, assuming none of the data shows a strain on hospital supplies and capacity.
We did a whole show on kind of unpacking the back on track plan, at least part of it yesterday. And we focused a lot on this stage, the stage two. We had an epidemiologist, well, the director, undergraduate director of epidemiology at IUPUI, and a public health expert on with us. We also had Brandon Smith, our Statehouse reporter, on. So if you are curious about stage two, which is the stage we're in right now, and also a little bit about the stages we're heading into, you can check that out on our podcast feed. What have we seen so far from these reopenings?
Yeah, so it's been a little bit of a mixed response from the business side. Samantha Horton, our business reporter, spoke to a restaurant that has moved to meal kits or like to-go kind of packages instead of in-person dining, mostly because of their concerns about health and safety. Even as the state is giving the okay signal, they're delaying anything that would reopen things. Malls have reopened outside of Marion, Lake, and Cass counties. And one of the things that we're keeping an eye out for is enforcement. How can businesses reasonably be expected to enforce capacity limits in their buildings? And if they aren't, what's the state's mechanism for responding to that? In response to those kinds of questions, the governor said people can still report workforce safety complaints to the state. As of last week, the state had issued verbal warnings to businesses in less than 10% of complaints it investigated, and zero cease and desist orders were issued. The other thing to keep in mind, especially for the greater context of this, is that in other states, when businesses have been asked to contribute to the enforcement of, for example, masks, people have been shot and killed. So there is a greater context to that as well.
And let's talk about what the governor called a test or control group. Churches and other places of worship are able to reopen this weekend, right?
Yeah. So stage two. It has nothing to do with the stages because it doesn't. There were no restrictions or delays within the plan for Cass and Marion and Lake counties. So statewide, no matter where you are, churches and other places of worship are able to reopen today. Without the CDC guidelines on how many people can be in a space. So the current guidelines from the state and the CDC bans gatherings of more than 10 people. But if you are attending a church service or synagogue or what have you, you are expected to maintain 6 feet of distance between you and others and are recommended to wear masks. The governor said on multiple occasions that people are at higher risk for COVID-19 complications shouldn't attend services. And he's hopeful that services will continue to do things like drive-in or live stream services or increasing the number of services being offered by an individual institution. But he said this week churches were the test or control group, and what happens within congregations will help inform the state moving forward. And he says that's because religious institutions are the state's most responsible group.
Let me get back to this. These exceptions to this, or if there are any. It was my understanding that counties like Marion and you said Lake and Cass are not necessarily allowing churches to reconvene this weekend, But is that not the case?
No, that is the case. So Marion and Monroe counties both said, hey, you know what? That's great, Governor, but our ban of having more than 10 people in a space, there is no exemption for religious institutions.
And the governor is supportive of this as well.
Yeah. The governor has said on multiple occasions, not only in this context, but in others, that local and county governments know better about what is happening in their communities than the governor can in Indianapolis at the state capitol. You know, he's not attached to every single county, and so he's relying on those local government bodies to make those kinds of decisions. And that, more importantly, as a result of state law, that they do take precedence over anything that the state is saying.
And again, this is Marion and Monroe County specifically?
Yeah, Marion and Monroe counties have done that specifically. During the press conference, Governor Holcomb brought up Logansport. I went to double check that because that didn't sound right, and it was not. So cities and towns individually can put more tighter restrictions on this particular aspect than the state government is. But as far as I know, it is just Marion and Monroe counties that have made the decision to not exempt religious institutions.
And so this makes sense, of course, because the biggest outbreak in the state, of course, is in Indianapolis, which makes perfect sense. Are there big numbers coming out of Bloomington that we know of?
I think Monroe County is just being more cautious. And there's also a little bit of the context that, as far as outbreak, Indianapolis has the most cases, but it does not have the highest concentration of cases by population density. That dubious designation goes to Cass County.
Gotcha. All right. And so let's take a closer look at some of the numbers from across the state regarding COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. So as of noon, more than 23,000 confirmed cases in the state. We hit 1,328 deaths, and more than 130,000 tests were done this week. So for context, last week we were at 18,500 for confirmed cases. We had just broken the 1,000 deaths threshold and had not yet hit 100,000 tests. And that testing is definitely due in part due to the state's partnership with OptumServe Health Services that launched on Wednesday, opening 20 testing sites. The state health commissioner expects an additional 30 sites will be opened in the coming days. And it's also important to note, with these testing sites specifically, if you belong to a higher risk group, either because of health or racial background, you do not have to have symptoms in order to get tested. The state's website has a form that you can fill out in order to register to get tested. But yeah, that's the important thing for the testing this week.
And so is that kind of a recent development? Have more tests become available to allow that to happen?
Yeah, the state announced the testing partnership last week. And it's just having the capacity to run those tests. OptumServe is a privately run company that is also doing a partnership in California as well.
Okay. And we are still engaging, of course, with the Indiana 2022 way. How do we get involved?
Yeah, you just need to text elections to 73224 to join the Indiana 2022 way. Of course, we're covering COVID-19, but we're also still going to be focused on the elections and sometimes sending information back and forth. So we're sending texts with information and questions every single week, trying to keep you engaged as we head into a funky election cycle.
And I am staring at my absentee ballot. It's on my desk right now. I need to fill it out and send it in. Have you gotten yours yet?
No, mostly because my roommate and I are bad at checking our mail. and also, it is a longstanding habit of mine to vote in person early for primaries.
Okay, so you're going to do that perhaps at the Benjamin Harrison site?
Perhaps. I usually use it as an opportunity to snap some generic election photos before for the purpose of news.
Ah, there we go. Well, Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thank you, Lauren, as always.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Up next, an art therapist and licensed mental health counselor at an Indianapolis hospital wanted to do something for the families who have to be isolated from their loved ones who are suffering or dying from COVID-19. We'll hear about this unique remembrance that she came up with. Next, I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. For the families of those who die from COVID-19, it's heartbreaking not just to lose a loved one, but to lose them without being able to be there with them. Up until recently, family members weren't allowed to be at their loved one's bedside because of the infectious nature of the virus. That's prompted the clinical program manager of the Healing Arts Project at Ascension St. Vincent Hospital in Indianapolis to get creative. Her name is Caitlin Knapp, and she joins us now. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you first just describe what you do with the Healing Arts Project?
Yeah, so our department is made up of creative arts therapists, and I myself am an art therapist and licensed mental health counselor by trade. Our team is made up of art therapy, music therapy, dance movement therapy, and pet therapy. And we offer services at the bedside on an individual basis to our patients who are admitted at Ascension St. Vincent Hospital. We also provide services on an outpatient basis, whether that's individual or group, to pediatrics and adults. We also service our Ascension St. Vincent associates as well. So we know that, you know, working in a clinical environment can be very stressful, even without, you know, COVID-19 present. And so it's very important for us as a department to service anyone who walks in our doors, whether they are a patient, a family member of a patient, or if they're an associate or a provider themselves. So we do a variety of services, as I mentioned, individual and group, that are all individualized and unique to the person who is receiving the services. So there's nothing cookie cutter about the work that we do. Everything is very individualized to that person and what their specific needs are at that time.
So then, to the best of your ability, for those of us who might not be familiar, can you kind of just tell us what art therapy is and what it's meant to do?
Yeah, so art therapy is a master's level profession. in which clinicians work with the patient or client, depending on what your environment or population is, to develop some therapeutic goals to address. And art therapists can be found in hospitals, community mental health facilities, schools, private practice, can be found in correction facilities. You know, anywhere you might see a talk therapist, you could also see an art therapist. So we find that art therapy is a really great way to sort of circumnavigate some of individuals' unconscious defense mechanisms. It's also a really great tool to process things such as trauma, or maybe working with a client who doesn't necessarily have the words they would need to describe what it is they're going through or what it is that they need to address or process. So you think about trauma. Trauma is stored visually in the brain. And so doing creative work with an art therapist can help you sort of process those emotions and those thoughts surrounding the event. You think about with children as well. Some of those children might not have the words to describe what it is they're experiencing or going through. And so by incorporating art therapy, you can really help give them those words, but also process things that might not come up just in traditional talk therapy. It's a very unique practice that we can offer to patients as just an alternative method for mental health and wellness.
And you're also a licensed mental health counselor. How does that experience guide your work as well?
Yeah, in the state of Indiana, it's been great having both my credential for art therapy, but also a license as a mental health counselor. Both just has an increased network of individuals that you can reach out to talk about what's going on in those fields. You know, we find that art therapy is very rooted in counseling and psychotherapy and psychology. And so it's just been very nice to have a large network of mental health counselors, in addition to creative arts therapists and art therapists in particular, that all sort of work within this field of mental health. So it's just an increased network, essentially, of people that we can work with. And it's been great to have both of those as I work. It's definitely not required that someone have both a license and a credential to practice. If I was, say, a private practice clinician, you know, you do bill under your license as a mental health counselor versus billing as your credential of an art therapist. But here in the hospital, we're very blessed to not need to bill insurances, given our Ascension St. Vincent Foundation and the work they've been able to help us provide these services completely free of charge to all of our patients and staff.
And so you're working under very different circumstances now compared to what I'm sure you and all of us are used to. Earlier, I mentioned that up until recently, families couldn't be at their loved one's bedside if they were in the hospital for COVID-19. So before we get to what you did specifically for those families, does that mean that the hospital now has lifted some of those restrictions or somehow found a way to allow families to be there?
Yeah, so the entire state of Indiana, all of our hospitals have been working very closely to make sure that we are all aligned and in very similar practices. So that way it's very congruent, regardless of which healthcare facility a patient or family is going to. And we worked with our spiritual care department, as well as nursing and operations and security. A lot of people were involved in this process. And we decided that there was a safe way that we could create a protocol here at Ascension St. Vincent where we could allow a certain number of family members to be at the bedside of a patient diagnosed with COVID-19 in an end-of-life situation. Now, of course, there are stipulations in which the duration, the frequency, and the number of people are all limited, just in terms of being able to keep those who are not affected by COVID-19 safe. But we have been able to expand that with our just growing understanding of where we stand currently and what other hospitals are doing. So, I know Indiana University has also moved to a similar protocol on expanding their end-of-life visitation for COVID-19 and PUIs, or patients under investigation of COVID-19.
So what did you decide to do for these families?
So for these families, given the nature of our visitation as it's been expanded, we can only have a certain number of family members at the bedside for a short duration of time. And so for larger families or even extended families who normally would be at the hospital or would be able to come see them, we wanted to be able to offer them some sort of service, some sort of processing that we can use in this complex grief and this very difficult time of not being able to be with our loved ones. So we've developed a legacy print protocol in which we can take a physical print of the patient's thumb and we scan it and edit it and then digitally share that with the family. So there's no risk of transmission of a physical print leaving the hospital. And that way they can take these prints and they can distribute them amongst family members who are not able to physically be there, or keep it themselves as they were likely not able to see their loved one up until this end-of-life moment.
We're talking with the clinical program manager of the Healing Arts Project at Ascension St. Vincent Hospital in Indianapolis. And I'm sure that this is just one part of the end-of-life care that you're helping to administer. What else have you been doing for patients and families regarding COVID-19?
Yeah, our Healing Arts Department is very blessed to continue to be at the bedside and provide services to our patients throughout this entire COVID-19 crisis. We have not left the hospital. We have been here at the bedside providing those individualized care sessions to our patients, and we've only increased the number of service offerings and projects that we have specifically set aside for staff as well. So it's very important to us as creative arts therapists to continue to provide that normalcy, sense of routine, and a way to process some of the anxiety that comes with being hospitalized, not only in addition to whatever health concerns they have, but also any concerns they have being in a hospital with seeing strangers in masks. It can be very disorienting for some patients. So we've been very blessed to be able to continue to provide services and process everything that's going on related to COVID-19 or other with these patients. And so some of the projects we've been using specifically for staff, one of our biggest ones was our Hope Lives Here campaign. I'm sure you've been seeing a lot of hearts and rainbows in the community as a sign of hope. And we definitely wanted to participate in that. And so we had patients and volunteers and staff members create individual rainbows so that way we can put them together. I think we have upwards of 100 individual handmade rainbows that we've made copies of, and we have them laminated and presented across the hospital in common areas. We also have them to distribute to COVID-19 patients and PUIs to have in their rooms, just as a sign to say that, you know, your community is behind you and you're not alone in this experience. And that, you know, we're thinking of you, and you know, we're hoping for good health, and that there is, you know, a sign of hope beyond the storm. And so we've also been painting rainbows in common areas as well. So that's one of our bigger ones. But our music therapist and dance movement therapist have also implemented an associate email gram, which has been wildly successful. Associates can request specific messages or words of encouragement or fun anecdotes or inside jokes to them, and they create a musical rendition and dance moves for that message, and then share it with that specific associate, which has been a really wonderful way to stay connected, as we have all of our associates are leaning into this work, and they might be working in different units or different departments depending on where the need is. Or perhaps they're at home working, and it's just been really nice to be able to connect them in that fun, creative way.
I want to come back to what you said about the kind of grief that these families are going through. You said it's complex. What makes you say that?
So when you think about how someone is grieving, whether it is an imminent death, something that is quick, or something that is prolonged, generally in the hospital, these family members can be with them. They can physically touch them. They can be present with them to sort of process that loss. But with the COVID-19 and visitor restrictions and the precautions we have in place to keep them safe, they're not able to be with their loved one at the bedside up until the end of life. So the time that they would have to be able to process that loss or that transition into a bereavement stage is definitely altered just based by the nature of what we can have in the hospital right now.
Have you gotten any feedback from these families regarding the thumbprint process? What have they said about this?
All the families that I've spoken with, we work directly with spiritual care to set up the end of life sessions, and then I complete the thumbprints after verbal consent has been approved from the family. And the families they're amazingly supportive and very appreciative of having this offered to them. I had a session today where I actually got to complete the print with the family in the room. So I was able to help add some processing time so they could be a part of the legacy print process. And they can see that the print is being taken, and I can sort of walk them through the process. And also had some time to process and reminisce on their loved one and the life they lived up until that point. So it's been very rewarding for me to be able to work with them. But they've definitely seemed very appreciative of the service we've been able to offer.
Can you talk about the approach to care at your hospital, Ascension St. Vincent, and why it makes an idea like this, like yours, possible?
Ascension St. Vincent has been very supportive of our creative arts therapies and our healing arts department in general. We have champions at all levels of administration, whether that's in the chiefs, the C-suite with our chiefs, or at the level of managers and supervisors on the floor. But I mean, it's been very well received prior to COVID-19, but even more so now, them seeing the need for these types of services to be offered to our patients and to staff members as a way to help process and cope. But here at Ascension St. Vincent, we truly look at the entire individual mind, body, and spirit, and the existence and implementation of this type of creative arts therapies practice only goes to support that we truly are looking at more than just physical health of a patient. We're really trying to look at every aspect of their needs, whether that's emotional, psychological, social, any level, and what they might need beyond their physical support. Being able to have an integrated interdisciplinary team, such as social workers and spiritual care and a variety of other clinicians and providers, has really been a true blessing to be able to have this holistic approach to care here.
It seems like there is a broad diversity to the kind of work that you do. So I'm not even sure if this is a valid question, but is this project that we're talking about today, the Thumbprint Project, typical of the kind of work that you do with art therapy?
Yes, I do bereavement work as an art therapist. I generally serve our adult inpatient population, but legacy, bereavement, and grief are something that is definitely ingrained in our practice prior to the COVID-19 crisis. It's just a little bit different in how we practice it. Generally, what a session might look like in the hospital is working directly with the family of the patient to include them in that process. So that way we can make sure that we're capturing what is most important to them, and then, just take that as additional time to process this loss as it comes about. And now with the family only being at the bedside for a certain period of time, I don't always have the ability to process directly with the family or even have them be involved in the taking of the thumbprint. So it's very different in that it's sort of happening on the back end, and then services are being offered virtually, and then after the legacy print has been taken and edited and then digitally distributed. So it's definitely a part of our practice prior to COVID-19, and it will continue to be a part of our practice as creative arts therapists, but it might just look a little different.
Right now, many of us are looking toward the healthcare industry for perspective on the COVID-19 crisis. So from your post, What do you want people to know about this moment in time?
I think it's very important that we think about, you know, our loved ones. And I know that it's very difficult to be self-isolating and be away from our loved ones at this time. But just knowing that we are connected and there are resources available to you virtually, whether that is, you know, through mental health facilities or reaching out to friends and family, even though it is difficult to be physically connected, I think it's very important for all to know that, you know, we're truly all in this together. And these are uncharted waters that we're navigating together. And, you know, we will get through this, and to just reach out to those nearest them for support when they need it.
Caitlin Knapp is Clinical Program Manager of the Healing Arts Project at Ascension St. Vincent Hospital in Indianapolis. Caitlin, thank you for what you do, and thanks for your time today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Up next, a look at how climate change and pollution have threatened the Great Lakes and the research being done at Purdue to understand its impact. We'll talk with the IUPUI professor who co-authored a recent article that found its way into Discover magazine about harmful algal blooms. That's in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. The Great Lakes hold 20% of the planet's surface freshwater. They also provide drinking water to tens of millions of people. But clean water in the Great Lakes is anything but certain. Gabe Filippelli is a professor of earth sciences and director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI. He is also co-author of a recent article on how pollution and climate change have caused major threats to water quality in the Great Lakes. And he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome back, Gabe.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So let's set the scene here and share just how bad it can get. What happened in Lake Erie in the summer of 2014?
Lake Erie got a sort of a triple whammy. So what happened was that that we had changes in the biological production and circulation of Lake Erie that caused a couple things. One is it caused a very large algal bloom, and these algae thrive off of excess amounts of nutrients. So, and oddly, they actually self-propagate. So once you get an algae bloom started, it continues to get worse and worse until finally it all dies off after a number of days or a week. This particular algae bloom also produced toxins, these what are called neurotoxins, that are extremely harmful to wildlife and to people. So this algal bloom grew in Lake Erie, and finally on July 31st of 2014, that algal bloom had sort of taken over the only freshwater intake supply for the city of Toledo. And when it did that, they could not clean up the water that they were bringing in because of this neurotoxin. And so the city had to put a do not drink, do not boil order, which is really unique. You hear of do not drink, boil first orders, right? For E. coli, for example, which dies immediately when you boil it.
Yeah.
But in this case, yes, you can boil and kill the algae, but it would release all of those neurotoxins and make them aerosolize, or actually, you know, allow you to ingest a ton of them. So you couldn't do anything with the water.
Oh my goodness! But only it was this particular algal bloom that sort of produced this neurotoxin. Do others not do that?
The weird thing about climate change, we'll be talking a little bit more about climate change in the Great Lakes in a minute, but climate change seems to have initiated this spiral of harmful algal blooms across the world. So these bacteria, these algae, have been, you know, functioning, and they've been contaminating water supplies for decades, especially where, you know, largely from human impacts. But it's only been in the last 10 to 15 years that they've really started to turn toward producing these neurotoxins as some kind of response. The best we can guess is it's related to climate change. And so we see these neurotoxins produced in algae blooms in lakes here in Indiana. And it's responsible for many pet deaths, for example, as well as the Great Lakes. So it's a curious phenomenon. but it's one that looks like it's around for the long term.
So many of these things, when we talk about it, I mean, we will be getting into climate change as a factor here. But so many of these things are easy to ignore because you can't really see the changes. But these algal blooms that you're talking about have a very distinct look to them. Can you just describe what they look like?
They look like a green slime. So the algae themselves turn the water like bright green. Like you would expect, these are a certain kind of algae that are photosynthetic algae. So bright green water, kind of like a leaf, but in water, and cause foaming because algae themselves secrete various oils and so forth, and make them, and they smell. So all of it's bad. But what's particularly problematic with some of these systems is that we have algae blooms here in some of our drinking water reservoirs in Indiana, but we have ways to filter those out, some of the algae out, until it gets, unless it gets to this high of a concentration. But we also have the capacity here in Indiana to, if the reservoir's gone algal, most of our drinking water reservoirs we can supplement, or systems we can supplement with groundwater, right? So we can turn off the fresh water until the algae bloom subsides, and turn on the groundwater, which is always much cleaner. But in this case, in Toledo, they had no alternative groundwater system. So they were just at the mercy of whatever happened, and they had to wait until the bloom ended in Lake Erie.
Oh, my gosh. And how long did that take? It seems like they're here and gone pretty quick, but that can affect things pretty far down the road, too.
It can. So 3 days. It was a total of 3 days, and again, they had no options. And it's not likely you can build in options in a lot of these cities around the Great Lakes because the groundwater supply isn't quite adequate. Mm.
Okay. So the factors that contributed to this, you started kind of going into that a little bit. We're talking about climate change. We're also talking, I would assume, about a degree of runoff, right? And so how right. are those working together? How did it end up being a problem in there? And also, how could that end up being a problem here?
Right. Now, interestingly, I've been with a couple programs with you where we've covered both of these topics. So it'll be fun to kind of circle back around.
Indeed.
So one of them is climate change. I'll start with that. The Purdue Climate Change Research Center is just wrapping up a Herculean effort to produce climate change impact assessments. So they examine various sectors of how climate change will impact Indiana. One of them includes just a general climate a climate report. And what we find from climate is what we expect with climate change, which is it's going to get warmer. But probably one of the biggest impacts is an increase in extreme precipitation events. These monster storms. South Bend has experienced several of them in the last 5 years. And these monster storms end up just flooding wastewater treatment plants and triggering the release of a lot of raw sewage into the waterways. And, you know, we see that with Indianapolis. I mean, we have this, the deep tunnel project, which is working to eliminate our sewage flows into our waterways. But even that isn't designed to handle what climate change is already bringing to us. So that's the climate change picture. And in a nutshell, it's the extreme precipitation has gotten worse for the last 15 years, and it will get worse still. So that's something to be aware of. Then we have the infrastructure issue, which I alluded to. As a lot of these towns, and farms, so there's a lot of farms in this area. When you get extreme rainfall events, the towns' stormwater systems can't cope, right? And so they flush raw sewage and a lot of nutrients into waterways. And similarly, farm fields, when they got washed over by extreme precipitation events, you get a lot of fertilizer runoff. So the combination of those two ends up putting a lot of nutrients into these waterways, and the algae love them. These harmful algal blooms grow because they have a ton of these nutrients in them. And once you get the nutrients in the water system, they not only feed the bloom once, but that bloom falls down to the bottom of the water, let's say Lake Erie or Lake Michigan, where it promotes geochemical conditions that allow even more nutrients to leak up from below. So you're getting this washed in from above and leaked up from below. So it takes these systems then take a long time to recover.
So you mentioned infrastructure solutions that can alleviate this sort of thing. Things like the Dig Indy Tunnel project, which is happening here in central Indiana, Indianapolis specifically. What are some other ways, perhaps not infrastructure, but policy that could get ahead of things like this that maybe we haven't gotten to yet?
Yeah, so the policies to get ahead of it is ones that that people are promoting even here for Indianapolis, recognizing that the Dig Indy project isn't going to be quite adequate to deal with some of these extreme precipitation events. And that's to enhance the absorbability of the city. Okay, so think of, you know, this used to be a forest, and then we cut the forest down and built a city. But as a city grew, we kept building surfaces that don't absorb any water. So roofs of buildings, streets, sidewalks, parking lots. And so that means that when rainfall comes down, that stuff, that rainfall washes really quickly off of those surfaces and into the stormwater systems, which overwhelms them immediately. So if you can make the city itself more absorbable, so enhance what we call green infrastructure, enhance parks, remove asphalt, have development, municipal development laws in place that require developers to have 20-30% absorbable surface, for example, on new developments. Those kind of actions can work without even dealing with some of the other stormwater issues. Those alone can improve environmental quality.
We're talking to Gabe Filippelli, is professor of earth sciences and director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI and co-author of the new article, Climate Change Threatens Drinking Water Quality Across the Great Lakes. And we, so in order to understand today's challenges, let's go back to the early 70s with respect to the Great Lakes, because these problems around the Great Lakes, not these problems specifically, but general problems around the Great Lakes for water quality are nothing new, and neither are the big public attempts at solving those problems. What were we dealing with back in the early 70s, and what did we do about it?
Right. And that's actually a great place to start. Because by the early 70s, it was when the birth of the first environmental movement, right? That's Earth Day, the first Earth Day 50 years ago. And it was an awareness that we had these lakes, like Lake Erie, for example, which was incredibly degraded. You know, industries would dump raw sewage into it. We allowed, the industries to just dump into rivers and into lakes directly. We had a tremendous amount of excess nutrients in Lake Erie. So these algal blooms were frequent back then, too. You know, granted, they didn't turn harmful, like they didn't produce these neurotoxins, but nevertheless, they degraded water quality tremendously. And so the EPA set in, is formed in the early 70s, and they set in a set of laws called that are comprised within something called the Clean Water Act, to force municipalities to improve and industries to improve their practices. And so the reason why I keep harping on Lake Erie is it's one of the furthest downstreams of the lakes. So they basically get all of the stuff that accumulates from Superior through Michigan and Huron into Lake Erie. But regardless, all of these Great Lakes were degraded, even our own Lake Michigan. But these rules that went into place that became more and more strict as the decades went on have cleaned up the lake significantly. And it up until about 5 or 10 years ago, it was a real hallmark of how you can do environmental protections and improve water quality, improve fisheries, improve tourism. Tourism along the Great Lakes is, huge now. But it seems like a lot of these, the good impacts have been eroded over the last 5 to 10 years, largely because of climate change. And kind of, I think we've taken our eye off the ball a little bit in this.
Yeah. And so what we're dealing with now is not necessarily what we were dealing with then. Climate change is bringing other things as well. springtime warming you touch on the article. What is that about?
Yeah, so that is the warming the context of climate change. And we've experienced it right here. I've lived in Indiana for 25 years, and winters are markedly different. Winters are shorter, generally milder. Yeah, occasionally we get a fierce one, but generally milder. But the most important thing is that the spring warming comes earlier. So we get thawing significantly earlier, about 5 days on average, I think, for Indiana. Arrange it 5 days to 2 weeks earlier, depending on where you are in Indiana. But what that does is it just lengthens the growing season of these algal blooms. Because of agricultural practices also, you get a lot of these nutrients that run off into the waterways. Now, one of the key differences, and I will grant this easily, is that we have gotten rid of a lot of those point sources. So those factories that you just dumped, raw sewage into waterways and lakes, that they do not exist anymore. I mean, it is all treated. So that's a great thing. But climate change is actually fighting against our efforts to continue this improvement in water. And it's rough. I think we just have to be aware of it.
Well, yeah, but let's look ahead. How are things expected to change over the decades to come?
Yeah, so extreme precipitation events in the northern part of Indiana, and that's the closest we can get to as a proxy for, let's say, most of the Great Lakes, are going to be continuing to increase by about 16% by the year 2040 to 2050. So that's within a reasonable span. So what that just means is that we'll have something like five more extreme storm events per year than we have now. And that means five more times where you are washing raw sewage into waterways. And if that comes in the spring, summer, or fall, then it has a capacity to cause these algal blooms to grow.
And are we looking ahead at those problems right now and figuring out maybe how we can meet them head on?
No. In a nutshell, I believe there's a lot of efforts. For example, the Purdue Climate Change Research Center's assessment is exactly to do that. Let's look forward and provide municipalities with some tools. Not that we can predict climate exactly, but we have a pretty good guess based on these climate models. Especially since climate's already been changing here. The Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute is trying to implement tools also at the municipal level to provide information for cities to become more resilient in the face of climate change, to allow them to start doing bold moves like, let's have a change in regulation so developers have to enhance green infrastructure on every new development, or let's add in climate projections to every stormwater infrastructure project that we do, because we know it will happen. So I think people are motivated and they need information. And fortunately, we are beginning to get this kind of information. But of course, information is only good if you act on it.
Gabe Filippelli is a professor of earth sciences and director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI. He's also co-author of the article Climate Change Threatens Drinking Water Quality Across the Great Lakes, which can be found at theconversation.com and in Discover magazine. Gabe, thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. And if we're not on every day where you live, find our podcast wherever you get podcasts. We are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Join us on Monday for a conversation with Indiana Fever legend Tamika Catchings, who was recently inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame and has a new book coming out. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and have a great weekend. This is All In.